So Freeport Sulfur was involved in much more than just sulfur.
Yes, they were involved. They had aspirations to be a mining company, and they were in the manganese mining business in Cuba. They wanted to develop other mining operations. That was the only one that the manganese one was the only one that was successful. The molybdenum, we were taking samples on a big molybdenum prospect in the north end of Death Valley in a place called Allen Gulch. And it was a very interesting thing. There was a big exposed cliff about 1,000 feet high and maybe a mile or two across, and was almost pure molybdite on the surface. Mm. And it, you know, you just thought there must be tremendous amounts mm-hmm. behind that. But we took, you know, drove all sorts of, took samples from the top and drove tunnels in the side, and what had obviously happened, all the molybdenum that had ever been there had leached out and deposited on the surface. Mm-hmm. So it had a tremendous deposit, 1,000 feet by a couple of miles and an eighth of an inch thick. But the prospects were so intriguing that we spent a lot of money and time mm-hmm. doing it. But it, for me, it was a great experience and a great time.
Who were some of the people you were working with at that time?
Most of them have gone on to other things. One was a geologist named Ralph Taylor, who subsequently worked and I think eventually retired as a sort of the geologist with Exxon in charge of their non-oil geological kind of things, because I think Exxon went through a phase of wanting to get into non-oil things. And I've really forgotten most of the names.
But you had a mixture of backgrounds then.
Oh, yes. Yes. The others were mining engineers, mm-hmm. and I was the chemist, and did all the sampling and that kind of thing.
When did you come back from Nevada then?
I think my recollection is that I spent most of 1940, I spent 38 in Cuba, most of 1940 in Nevada. And I came back from Nevada probably in late 1940, attended a AICHE meeting in New Orleans, probably January of 40, sat next to a man who was director of engineering for Merck at a luncheon. And I think at that particular point I had very interesting assignments, and it looked like I was going to probably get stuck back in Freeport on some fairly routine kind of job. And he asked me if I wanted to come and work in Merck Engineering. And at that point, Merck, they just authorized the fortification of flour and bread with vitamins. The antibiotics were just coming in. The war was developing in Europe. Merck was building sulfur drug, synthetic vitamin plants just as fast as they could. And I went to Merck to work in designing and building those as a project engineer, building those. And I must have built three or four nicotinic acid plants, several sulfur drug plants. Toward the end of my stay at Merck, Merck got involved in penicillin, and one of Dr. Fleming's assistants came to Merck. I think it was a Dr. Heatley, and he was a rather shy bachelor in a strange town, and we had apartments in the same building, and
this was in Rahway.
In Rahway, and he, you know, brought the technology for making penicillin, and just before I left Merck, I designed they were growing penicillin in flask and extracting it in the laboratory, and I designed a 4-inch Pyrex column to extract penicillin from the laboratory flask, and it made about a dose of penicillin an hour,
mm-hmm.
and that was part of the beginning of penicillin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at that point, the war was going on. I'd gone to an ROTC school. Merck would have kept me out, but this was the biggest thing that was going to happen in my lifetime, and I wanted to see what's going to be in it. So I went in the Army on St. Patrick's Day, 1942.
You enlisted then?
Well, I was called as
ROTC.
Went to a sort of officer's pool outside of Washington, and I sat around for about 2 weeks when people would come in and interview me to see if they wanted me to work in their munition plant or their chemical warfare plant or whatever. And it made no sense to me to leave a good, and most of these guys were, most of them at that point were people who had gotten in a year or two before because it was the best job they could find. And most of them were people I wouldn't want to work for. So I was successfully discouraged all of them from taking me. and apparently there's a rule that if you weren't chosen in 2 weeks, you got shipped out. And I got shipped to Panama. And in Panama, it looked like I was going to get some sort of supply job. And I heard of a job that was open, and I asked for it, which is sort of contrary to the normal Army procedure. But this was this commanding officer of an old regular Army heavy mortar company, which I'd been in the ROTC, I'd been in the infantry, but sometime just before my junior year, something came out that said any chemical engineer wants to transfer to the chemical warfare service can, and you can go to camp, ROTC camp, between your junior and senior year in Maryland. And this is how I made my one trip, mm-hmm. and went to New York in the course of it. But I joined the Chemical Warfare Service to get this trip to the East Coast. And so I was in the Chemical Warfare Service, got down there, and the Chemical Warfare Service had done one good thing, and that is they had developed a mortar, which, as you know, is a high angle of fire,
mm-hmm.
That was much more accurate than any of the infantry. Any of the other mortars that were developed. And it shot about a 40-pound shell, and it had been originally developed to shoot white phosphorus and things like that, and it had been converted to an infantry weapon. And this was an old regular Army company, and I became commanding officer of it, the first non-regular Army officer they had ever seen. The youngest man in the unit was on his second enlistment. Some of them had 25 or 30 years service. It was an interesting experience to take over something like that, and I learned fast. And in the course of time, we stayed there a year. And in the course of this, as a sideline job, installed a smoke screen around the canal. And then we came back to the States, were expanded into a battalion, and got 1,000 draftees off the train one Labor Day, I guess, 43, and trained that winter, went to the Pacific, and spent the rest of the war in the Pacific.
Mm. Where in the Pacific were you at?
Well, we landed, we stayed, we were in Hawaii first, the battalion started getting broken up, and different parts of it going to different places, and they went to Saipan, Guam, Peleliu. Then we went together, got back together on Lady, and we the first landing on Lady, and then landed on Okinawa. And it, after the Okinawa landing, had come back to Lady and had already loaded on ships to land on in Japan when the war was over.
So you were really in the thick of things for a number of years.
Yeah, I was. For a couple of years, I was in pretty much the... We landed, about 30 or 40 minutes after anybody landed, and gave close support to the infantry, because we could get our mortars ashore much easier and faster than you could get artillery ashore. So we were among the first going.
Yeah. Any particular experiences from those two years?
Well, lots of experiences.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back a little bit, both to time just before you went to Merck.
Yeah.
I found two things from 1939. One, a publication you had, and another, a patent. With somebody by the name of Chatelain,
yes.
And I was curious about the one publication in Chemical and Metallurgical Engineering about low-capacity sulfur burners.
Oh, well, that, yes. I invented a sulfur burner. There was a need at that point for a sulfur burner that you could control. There were lots of sulfur burners, but you put sulfur in and burned them, and there was very little control of them. Now, the particular need for which I built this was in water treating. At least in this particular case, in the course of treating this particular water, it got too alkaline. And so you had to acidify it. And so instead of using sulfuric acid, I had the idea, well, we will burn sulfur, and it also removed oxygen. It acidified the water and removed oxygen. It was a great idea. And I designed this little burner where the amount of sulfur you burn was determined just by the amount of air you put through it. By changing the airflow, you could change that. And I got several interesting things about that. One, in the course of this, I went out to the sewage department at Phoenix, Arizona, and helped them install a boiler. But the most interesting one I ever had was, and some guy who was, and I don't remember any names, some guy who was developing and printing all the films for the studios in Hollywood had trouble getting sodium thiosulfate. And he decided he wanted to make sodium thiosulfate. So I went out and helped him develop a burner so he could make sodium thiosulfate. I think he made it maybe for a few years and then, or maybe months, and then someone started making it for him. But for some reason, at that particular point, he was having great trouble getting it. And that was also one of the required reagents in developing film. That was my one Hollywood experience. But the thing I remember about it was that he took me to about the second night of Gone with the Wind.
Really?
Not the opening night, but about the second or third night of Gone with the Wind. But that, the other thing is that years later, I was in India on a trip connected with Petrotex, and visited a sugar mill there, and they were using one of my burners up in the in northern India, within the sight of the Himalayas.
Oh my goodness! Who was Schaffeling? Was he?
He was the classmate at LSU who had gotten me. Gotten me to come there. And the last time I heard of him, he was in ill health somewhere in South Louisiana.
The other patent there was is titled "Liquid Mixture Suitable for Use in Drilling Wells."
Kind of almost forgotten what that was.
The only note I have is a drilling fluid that contains molten sulfur
glycol. Okay. Yes, and this turned out to be interesting for different reasons. At that particular point in the oil drilling business, they were having trouble with something called heaving shale, now which was a shale formation which, when water hit it underground, it swelled. And so there was a need for an anhydrous drilling fluid, and there were a lot of people trying to use oil-based drilling fluids, and that you never get them anhydrous enough. But what these things didn't, you drill into them, they would swell and close the hole. And as you probably, do you know anything about drilling oil wells?
Just a little bit.
Well, what you have is you've got a bit, and the drilling is really done by a mud that is circulated through the bit, and it carries the cuttings up out of the hole. It provides several functions. It cools and lubricates it, but it also sort of incidentally sort of builds up a little coat, on the side of the, that helps sort of keep the hole open. Well, they were running into places where they had this anhydrous shale that when water hit it, it would swell and close the hole. And so the idea of using molten sulfur as a drilling fluid. But other people had tried this, but the thing that was wrong with it is that molten sulfur has very peculiar thermal characteristics. It is very fluid right at the melting point, but if you heat it much past the melting point, it gets very, very viscous. It goes through a very viscous stage. So if you heated it hot enough to keep it from cooling off, it was too viscous to pump. And I developed something, it was a thiokol type material to go in the sulfur to reduce the viscosity at this higher temperature. And we drilled one well with it, and maybe another one, but I only remember one. And I think by that time, somebody developed better ways to handle this shale problem. But it didn't revolutionize it.
Your experiences with Freeport Sulfur up to this point were quite varied then. How did
they
get these different assignments, or did you select something?
Well, first I did. Second, I was single. Most of my contemporaries were married. And, somehow if you're single and willing to go, and there are married guys who don't want to go to Cuba for a year, you collect those assignments, and that's basically why I did. I wanted to do it, and I was free to do it.
It must have been quite a change then going to Merck, where now you're in plant design.
It was a very interesting change because nobody was interested in anything but Merck except getting these things built as fast as you can. I don't ever remember making a cost estimate. I remember being under lots of pressure about time schedules, but nobody worried about money. And so you just had a free hand to do almost whatever you wanted to, as long as you got them built and made them run. And so it was a completely different experience. And it was a time when I worked very hard. We worked long hours because there was a lot of pressure to get things done there. And Merck too was Merck is a great company now, and it was a good company then. It was at least this part of Merck was run almost entirely by scientists. The research people really dominated, and they had some very fine research people.
How did Merck react to your wishing to join the military as opposed to staying there?
They objected a little bit, but when it was apparent that I really wanted to do it, then they quit. And we even, in effect, negotiated a time for me to leave. They arranged with the Army for me to stay and let finish whatever I was working on. And I left after that.
Now, you didn't leave the military until 46, is that correct?
Well, that's when I officially left. I left. I'd been overseas most of the time. I had lots of accumulated leave. So I really left the military about November 45. And I came, landed in San Francisco, and I decided I wanted to get my career thing settled before I took any vacation. Came to New York, talked to Merck, and whatever they offered didn't seem very exciting. Freeport at that point professed to want to make some and get in a major expansion, and wanted to do something in what we would now call the petrochemical business. And I went to work for them with the idea of getting them into some major expansion of their business, very likely in the petrochemical part of it.
Well, by this time, Dow had already had its Freeport facilities.
Yes, Dow, that was really the start of it, but Dow's original start was in magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the day I left Freeport to go to work for Merck is the day the first magnesium, Dow produced the first magnesium. I was in the local cafe eating breakfast in preparation for leaving when two or three Dow people brought in the first ingot of magnesium to show to all the local people. But at Dow's petrochemical activities came some, I guess they came later in the war.
Yes, because they were producing styrene there during the war.
Yeah, okay.
And
yes.
I think that was their first big facility there,
yes.
Was the styrene.
Yeah.
So by the time you returned, Dow was a principal.
Yeah.
Force in Freeport.
Oh, yes, they were. Now, I didn't come back to Freeport. I came back to New York. I went to work in New York.
I see.
Yeah.
What were your first responsibilities with them then when you went to New York?
Well, my first responsibility really was to find things for them to do this way.
Okay.
And somewhere in the Freeport file, you can find reports of mine recommending that they do, at one time or another, almost everything that has been done on the Gulf. You know, the course that Carbide took, that Monsanto took. But the problem with Freeport was that sulfur business was so good that nothing you did looked good in comparison to it. So this was just a series of good ideas that weren't quite good enough to, it didn't look good compared to what they were doing. But one of the first things I did, or not close to the first, was to go to Germany on one of these Fiat missions to Germany. I spent probably five or six months in Germany on one of the technical missions. And
what was Germany? This would have been what then? 46.
Yeah.
What was? Well, that was Germany. Right in the war it ended.
But yes. Well, Germany was in terrible shape. Peter Spitz, you know Peter Spitz?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Peter's written a book that includes some of this.
Okay.
And there was, after the, you know, there were two things that might be interesting. One, there was something called the Strategic Bombing Survey. Have you run across that?
I think I've heard the name, but that's...
Okay, well, this was something right after the war, and by right after, I mean days or weeks after the war. There was a group of American engineers and technicians sent over to see what damage had been done by the strategic bombing. And this included a number of people that you probably might want to talk to, except that I've forgotten who they were, but they were well-known engineers and technicians. Probably as a result of that, or maybe not as a result, there was something called the Fiat, and God, and I can't remember what was set up, but it was an agency. There was a group that was set up to study German industry to see what things they had that would be useful to us, and it was headquartered where is the Hoechst headquarters?
It's not Ludwigshafen, is it?
No, it's out of Frankfurt.
No, I don't remember offhand.
Yeah, the Griesheim was the next place, but it was one of the semi-suburbs of and it's where at least at that point, the Hoechst headquarters were. And this was a semi-military operation. We wore uniforms, but not any officers' insignia, and had a patch that said scientific consultant.
Mm.
And we were supposed to be treated like officers of some indefinite rank. And we lived in the Army officers, when we traveled, we lived in Army officers' quarters, and we traveled out of transportation provided by the motor pools, and we had to write reports on what we did. And I was over there interested in two things, acetylene from methane, and sulfur processes generally. And I wrote, and jointly with a DuPont director, what they call the Jackson Lab, a guy named Nick Carter, and his name was not Nicholas, Nick was a nickname, and I've forgotten what his initials were, but Nick and I spent a lot of time studying the SOXY process for converting methane to acetylene. And this is pretty much the process that I guess Tenneco used, that Monsanto at one point used and abandoned, where you have a furnace in which you heat methane and convert part of it into acetylene.